Hello.
Welcome back.
Welcome back to Hell Money Podcast.
We have a very exciting episode for you today.
Yeah.
Tentatively titled Crypto is Trash.
Crypto is Trash.
Yeah.
Last week I was the expert talking about Bitcoin astrology. Mm-hmm. Now Casey.
I was the empty vessel receiving receiving knowledge.
Yeah. And I think I actually converted you to being an astrology believer.
Yeah.
I don't need a comment from you on that either.
Let me say I like your astrology a lot. I mm-hmm. like your astrology takes a lot. I also love the like galaxy scale conflict
mm-hmm.
in astrology.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It really, like, if you break down like what you have to believe in order to believe astrology, like mm-hmm. it gets pretty insane.
But I actually
think I believe all of those things.
Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm a believer, but like we can go like enthusiast.
Yeah.
Or, like
yeah.
enjoyer.
Astrology enjoyer.
Yeah.
Specifically my variety of astrology.
Yeah.
But now you're the expert again.
Yeah.
And you're gonna tell me why all crypto is trash.
Right.
Which is something I feel like I know on like a vibes level.
Yep.
But like I need you to like give me
And I have copious notes about what mm-hmm. is wrong with what.
Yeah.
And this is something that I feel like I don't kind of see good takes on this subject enough.
Yeah.
I tend to see sort of extreme Bitcoin maxis who just call everything a scam, right?
Totally.
But I mean, that's not a convincing argument. Like, You need to say why are things a scam? Like why are there problems with things? And oftentimes it's very subtle. Like, you know, there are times where I'll see something new that's being developed and I will be like, huh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll get into the details and then I'll realize that, yeah, the details are like really problematic. This doesn't work. It's just going to break. And so I like hearing those sorts of takes from people about like, well, like not just like, oh, Ethereum is a scam, but like, why is Ethereum bad? What are the problems with Ethereum? Like, what's wrong with it, basically?
Yeah, I think what's difficult, too, is, like, I feel like people don't realize... People that feel very strongly about crypto or Bitcoin or mm-hmm. whatever
yeah.
don't realize the huge range of perspectives and levels of expertise that people have.
Yeah.
Also in, like, the crypto and Bitcoin space,
absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So I think, like... I feel like your perspective is this very technical perspective of like, this doesn't work or at scale, it's not going to whatever.
Yeah, right.
And so like you're begrudgingly, or maybe not begrudgingly, but you end up being a Bitcoin maxi, not
yeah.
like ideologically, but just practically.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just like, everything else is kind of trash, or like they have marginal advantages over Bitcoin that aren't enough to
mm-hmm.
be worth abandoning Bitcoin's network effect. Right?
Yeah.
yeah.
But I think it's like, I feel like there's a lot of people who are into crypto
mm-hmm. yeah.
who like have just genuinely never thought about it that deeply. And
right.
I feel like it's kind of like, I mean, even we were like trying to figure out whether we should call this episode something related to crypto or something related to altcoins.
Right.
Because, like, I feel like even that rebranding of, like, the cryptocurrency, Web3
yeah.
stuff,
yeah.
it's, like,
yeah.
it's, they don't want to be viewed mm. as, like, an altcoin. They
yeah.
want to be, like,
yeah.
the umbrella is including
this
Bitcoin.
Made me remember, I need to add what's wrong with Web3.
Web3, yeah.
to the list.
Yeah, yeah no, I would love to hear that as well. But I think, like, it is... It's partially like a marketing thing where
people just think
like blockchain technology
is
huge field that's going to have all these applications. And I, on a very non-technical level, just kind of feel like blockchain's not actually that useful.
Absolutely. Like, and this is something that I've thought a lot. It's that a blockchain is a very specialized thing. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a very specialized technology that's useful in a small number of scenarios in very specific ways. And so... you know, seeing it and thinking like, oh, now we're going to put a blockchain in everything. It's like saying we're going to put like an x-ray machine in everything. It's
yeah.
like, no, like x-rays like are great. You need them sometimes, like look at your teeth, but like you don't need an x-ray machine in your car. We're not going to make a better car by putting an x-ray machine in it.
Yeah.
And blockchain is very simple, very similar. Yeah. And also, you know, you have to look at Bitcoin as a holistic system. All these parts come together and make it work. And then you can't just like take parts out of it and jam them in other systems and expect those systems to be like better, right? It's like putting
mm-hmm.
like a fish tank aeration unit on your 747.
I went
like,
to
why?
This again. I mean, I've said this a million times, but when I was like getting to my like Bitcoin maxi phase of life, I was like going to like all, you know, crypto events as well. And I remember there was like a pivotal moment was I went to this blockchain meetup
uh-huh.
and there was like, I was talking to a group of people and there was this guy there who was like, hey, like, I'm here because I need, like, someone to help me. Like, I want to implement blockchain in my work. Uh-huh. And, like, I need, like, an expert to help me. And, like, all these, like, dude bros, like, you know, who worked at these, like, blockchain companies were like, what's your, you know, what's going on, man?
Yeah.
And this guy was like, I work with homeless people. Like, he's like a social worker. He's like, I work with homeless people and I want to put homeless people on the blockchain. Like, he was like, I want to put all of my cases on the blockchain. I want everyone to be on the blockchain. I want, like, if I give this person this, I want that to be on the blockchain. And, like, I was, like, listening to this and I was like, well, what? Like, do you have problems with, like, fraud or something? Like, you know, is it that, like, sometimes things get dispersed and you have no record? Like, are you trying to just do, like, record keeping? He was like, no, there's no, like, fraud or, like, record keeping issues. I just think blockchain is where things are headed, and I want social work to be in that too. Uh-huh. So I want to put homeless people on the blockchain. And all of these guys were like, well, here's a way you could do it. Like, they fully went with it. Oh, it was insane. Yeah. And so that was kind of a moment where I was like, oh my God, I've been having a conversation with these guys that are, and I think it's like partially because a lot of them are like businessy finance people and they're just looking for like little marketing things they can do to be like, this would be a really great way for us to get involved with like homeless activism or something, you know, the blockchain for homeless people.
Jesus Christ.
But that was, so I think like the, I mean, we have in our timeline, we kind of have like going through like the history of like crypto and like Bitcoin to altcoins to like, where are we now? Mm-hmm. And then we also have like crypto psychology.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like the crypto psychology is like, there's fucking layers.
Yeah,
to that
for
shit.
Sure. For sure. Yeah.
So yeah, that's my sort of, that was like my real like red pilling moment of being like, shit.
I think that's particularly interesting. Like, I find it kind of interesting when like, I know why I'm a Bitcoiner. Like I got into Bitcoin, I was interested in it, and I have the technical knowledge to look at other things and know that it's trash. And so I'm very interested in people who aren't, I mean, you're technical. I consider you a technical person. You're like a scientist, you know? But like people who don't have a technological or a programming dev cryptography background somehow have like a bullshit detector and it goes off with crypto and it doesn't with Bitcoin, which I think is interesting.
What, the programmers do have?
No. You as a non-programmer, non-dev, still have this like bullshit detector that you went to like crypto, non-Bitcoin crypto events and were like, oh, this is garbage.
Like, well, I think it's like also because I feel like, and this is like a distinction that I think, we talked about this in our Bitcoin Maxi episode too, like why I think like the kind of Bitcoin Maxiism is good is that I think like people who aren't into finance think that crypto sucks. They think it's all a scam, Bitcoin included.
Yeah.
And so like for me, it was like, I feel like I kind of went into it this with this perspective of like, you know, this is like maybe a way for a lot of people to just make money. Uh-huh. Like, but it does. I was like already sort of skeptical of
it. Right.
And then I was like, oh wait, Bitcoin might actually be the thing. Uh-huh. So it was sort of like Bitcoin kind of proved itself like beyond.
Yeah.
And I think like that is potentially a good way to get people who are not into crypto, who are pre-coiners, whatever, not into crypto at all, into Bitcoin, is like, just skip the fucking shitcoin phase, you know, and just go straight into the Bitcoin. Bitcoin is different. Bitcoin is better, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it's hard for people that are like into, like, I don't know, tech is the future. Like the blockchain's the future. Like that sort of like marketing style thinking. Like I feel like they're very susceptible to thinking like crypto is cool.
Yeah.
But if you're just like skeptical of marketing and finance and like bros who talk like that, then like it's not that hard.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah.
So let's dive into it.
Yeah, let's go.
So first, what's a segment of a podcast?
A segment.
But I feel like there should be some like word, like a the first movement of the podcast.
Yeah, act one.
Act one, crypto history.
Yeah.
So I sort of divide this up into four phases.
Mm-hmm.
The first phase is pre-Bitcoin. There's actually a lot of interesting stuff in here that people don't remember or people don't know about. The two examples, the things that people remember the best are probably E-Gold and Liberty Trust. E-Gold and Liberty Trust were both, you know, fully centralized entities that essentially tried to operate private banks over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
They were doxxed. I think E-Gold ran out of America, and Liberty Trust was like, you know, like some like, you know, Caribbean island like you know, jam.
Tax haven vibe.
Yeah, tax haven vibe, yeah. And they basically Egold offered you an account, and it was, like, denominated in grams of gold, and they held the grams of gold in some, like, vault somewhere, and you could send those grams of gold to other users.
So that those were attempting, or at least it sounds like Egold was attempting to solve, like, the fiat problem.
Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah, it was exactly, like,
we need to go back to gold. Yep. Let's do e-gold.
Yep. And okay. it wasn't like, it didn't have any like kind of technical innovations. It was just like, oh, now we can give people gold denominated bank accounts that they can access over the internet.
Yeah.
And then Liberty Trust was, I don't remember the details of how it, of like what their thing was, but they had the Liberty Dollar, which I don't remember if it traded at parity with the dollar or it was close or whatever, but kind of similar thing that they had this like dollar that you could move around. Both of them were wildly popular and were used by legitimate actors and non-legitimate actors alike, just because people, there's this very strong demand for, you know, digital value transfer, unregulated digital value transfer, and both of these satisfied. The other thing that I have on here, which I think is really interesting, is the Digital Monetary Trust. It was distinct from Egold and Liberty Trust in that it was a digital bank. But it was totally private and totally anonymous. And you just accessed it over the IIRC, the invisible internet something. There was this like pre-Tor privacy network.
Mm-hmm.
And DMT you just accessed over this like privacy network. And they ran for a while. And then eventually they were like, yeah, we're closing up shop. And they had an orderly shutdown. And nobody ever found out who they were. It was a totally anonymous pre-Bitcoin digital bank.
Damn.
Yeah, pretty
cool. For them.
Yeah.
So I guess it sounds like the motivations were to have like money that was tied to something in the form of e-gold, right? Yeah. And then also the anonymity, privacy, no like third party regulating force, whatever.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, yeah. So some people want that because they're, you know, money launderers or scammers or whatever.
Right.
But then also there's a like a cost to regulation, you know, like getting a bank account is hard. Making transfers when the traditional financial system is very hard, often very bad. It's slow. There are problems. So just somebody having a digital bank and making it as simple as possible had a huge amount of appeal.
Right.
Yeah. Also not on here is David Chom's eCash project, which was this card, this anonymous payment card. It was actually deployed in the United States in like Minnesota. I'm getting that wrong, but like Michigan or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it used quite sophisticated cryptography to be a private payment card. Like the merchants had no idea who the customers were. It was basically like a debit card with very good privacy.
Mm-hmm.
But that never really took off. But it's kind of taking off now in the form of Fediment, which is a Bitcoin digital eCash bank project. So I think this prehistory is really interesting because there's interesting stuff that nobody talks about. Oh yeah, and of course Egold and Liberty Trust had pretty famous like destruction by regulators. I think Liberty Trust was like just nuked by regulators. Egold was a story where they like tried to come into compliance, but it was expensive. And I think they kind of both died like post 9/11 in that new
crackdown
regime. Yeah,
it kind of isn't surprising to me if you're trying to operate a bank that there would be crackdown, even if you weren't that big,
right?
You know, like that is not. I feel like Bitcoin, it's like, okay, someone wants to buy, you know, some stupid internet token, let them, right? But like, if you're trying to operate a bank, I can understand the government like actually taking the time to crack down on that,
right? Yeah,
not that I necessarily agree, but you know,
that
makes sense to me.
Yeah. And then 2009, Bitcoin launches, and it's just the only thing in town. It's the only new cryptocurrency.
Well, it's a new thing.
New thing, yeah. Itself, right? But it's pretty clearly in a different category from everything else, even in the beginning. Like, I don't think anybody, Digital Monetary Trust, which I consider a great project, that is very distinct from Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin is like an unstoppable e-gold or digital monetary trust. So it really exists in its own category.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like an invention.
Yeah. It's an invention.
Or is it a discovery?
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. I think of it as a discovery. Very much so.
You think
yeah.
math is a discovery?
Well. I think the combination of features like the proof of work, blockchain, difficulty adjustment, transactions, P2P network, like that combination of features is was kind of out there waiting for somebody to put the pieces together. And Satoshi just happened to be the person who could see like, oh, look, I could put these pieces together like this. Like, I think it's kind of like a, you know, like a bicycle. You know, a bicycle is definitely an invention. But in another way, it's kind of a discovery. It's like, oh, yeah, if you put wheels like this and, you know, put some, you know, metal tubing and add some pedals, this is just like really efficient. It's this great, you know, thing.
I mean, at some point, then every invention is a discovery.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe that's what I believe, that every invention is a discovery.
Yeah.
I mean, but unlike, for example, a cultural object like The Simpsons, which is not a discovery. It's like very...
But that's not an invention. That's a creation.
Yeah. What invention is... Obviously not a...
I think a bike is an obvious invention.
No, I think it's a discovery. I think the bike is a discovery, yeah.
Maybe like the wheel is the...
But then once you have the wheel, the bike is like a... Like there's less steps to the bike, making it more discovery-like and less invention-like.
Yeah. I feel like Bitcoin is... Yeah, I don't know. I think math might be a discovery, but Bitcoin might be an invention. The blockchain might be an invention.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Either way, it's this.
It's like, revolutionary.
Revolutionary, and it's this great combination deal. of little things, and that kind of ties into what we were saying before about proof of work, blockchain. Mm-hmm. It's not this thing that you just rip out and use everywhere. It's like, oh yeah, it's this combination of bits that fits together really nice.
And it's like a very specific solution for a very, I feel like, specific-ish problem, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's why, yeah, I feel like it's easy to just think of blockchain as being like, this is like the new thing. And like in the future, we'll all be using blockchain.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We'll have every homeless person on the blockchain.
That is bonkers. That is bonkers. Like, that is fucking insane. Yeah, we're going to put homeless people on the blockchain. We're going to have a methadone token so you can, like, we can track their methadone usage on the blockchain.
But yeah, so the blockchain, Bitcoin is the invention of the blockchain.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And that's like, you know, it's a new thing. That's like 2009. Yep. 2008, 2009.
Yep. And then 2011, we sort of start seeing this period of really just like pure clones of Bitcoin, that people take the Bitcoin code base and they tweak a few parameters. Usually what they change is they change the supply, the number of coins. They change how those coins are distributed over time. Mm-hmm. They change how the Bitcoin difficulty adjustment works, which is how Bitcoin responds to miners starting and stopping mining Bitcoin. They change the proof of work algorithm to other proof of work algorithms. Just like copying the code base and like really minor. A lot of them were also sort of thematic. Like Potcoin was like, it was like a clone of Bitcoin that had nothing changed but a few parameters. And like, yeah, this one's for pot. And then there's like, you know, like Saudi coin and like Africa coin and like gold coin and like big coin, like where there was like only 10 of them. There's only 10 coins. Or like, just like, and it's like, yeah. So,
I mean, that does sound like altcoins now, you know, like the sort of like,
this was just even more like blatant. Like there's like, no, like the only thing that was different was the name.
Do you think it's that different from like Shiba Inu? You know what I mean?
No. Shiba Inu is definitely a thematic coin. Yeah.
I do think that there's still like that style.
Yeah. These
just having fun on the computer.
Yeah, having fun on the computer. Yeah. Oh man, yeah. This was a funny period. Like, it was just like a Cambrian explosion of junk. I think a big lesson, like, okay, like what was useful out of this? A big lesson is that Bitcoin gets all these things that these coins changed mostly right. Mm-hmm. And like, okay, like maybe the difficulty adjustment could be like slightly tweaked, or the supply could be slightly different, or the proof of work algorithm could survive some tweaks and be improved, but those advantages that you would get from doing that are so marginal, there's no reason to do them. Just like stick with Bitcoin, like whatever. Maybe it can be slightly improved, but like who cares?
Well, as a free market bro, you must be, you know, kind of enjoying that this happened then, because then you got the free market competition.
Yeah, totally. You know? Yeah. I mean, I mean, a lot of these were out and out scams.
You
just
know,
like
Potcoin was the best one.
Yeah. Let the best coin win. Yeah. That'd be hilarious. Like some future where we all use Potcoin. Yeah, but yeah, no. All these stuff. For all those blatant clones are dead in the water. Maybe the one that survived the most is like Litecoin. I don't even know when Litecoin
launched. Oh, Litecoin was that time?
Yeah, Litecoin is very, very early.
I don't even know. I don't know if you have Litecoin on this because I literally never
heard about it. Litecoin is unworthy of consideration.
The only reason why I know about it is because it's on Robinhood. I mean, now there's like a lot of different altcoins on Robinhood, but there used to only be like six or something. And it was like Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Ethereum Cash. Litecoin and then like Litecoin.
Yeah, Litecoin had this meme of like silver to Bitcoin's gold, which like I think a lot of people found that persuasive, but it actually doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
like,
why
just use like Bitcoin? You can use less of it. Like you can if you need to buy something with a dollar of Bitcoin, you can.
Yeah,
right. You don't need like, oh, you need some shitty less valuable thing to buy things with. It's so then we sort of start to get some projects that try to do something different and interesting. One very early example, which I think kicked off the 2011 sort of thing, was Namecoin, which tried to do distributed domain name lookups on a blockchain. So, you know, when you go to a URL bar and you type in, naturopathhomesteadertips.com,
right?
It finds some computer out there and connects you to that computer.
Mm-hmm.
That process of going from a domain name to a computer is done by something called the DNS, or the domain name system.
Mm-hmm.
And that is essentially a piece of centralized infrastructure that's run by basically ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which is some like, you know, foundation.
Is that Web 1 or Web 2?
We just call that the web. We don't call that Web 1. We call that the internet. And it's not the web, it's the internet.
Okay.
But yeah, like that's just like, That's very much the old school. It's not a government agency, but it has like ties to government.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly independent, mostly does a fine job. But Namecoin was an attempt to decentralize that and do that on the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
Namecoin is still around, but nobody uses it. It's like pretty dead.
Do you know who created Namecoin?
I don't. I don't know if they're anonymous, or I have a feeling they're not anonymous, but I don't remember or know who did it.
I'm just curious. I mean, I guess we'll probably get into this specifically more when we talk about crypto psychology, but I'm curious, like, throughout this timeline, like, what was the level of, like, genuineness, right? Like,
oh, sure.
When you're making, like, Potcoin, it's like, there's, like, not that. It's like, that's, like, a Dogecoin creator level of seriousness.
Yeah.
But, like, when does it cross over into seriousness and, like, why do people believe it, or are they manipulated into believing it? You know what I mean? Like, what
the there's like a spectrum between like people who believe that they're doing something useful and people who are like fully cynical and doing it for the money, and it's very fuzzy because people will really talk themselves, like when you have an incentive to believe something, you will really talk yourself into believing that it's the right thing to do.
Well, I think that even can apply for like super ideological Bitcoin maxis.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Right? Like if you just get into Bitcoin at the right time and like you succeed from Bitcoin succeeding, of course you're going to be like, Bitcoin is good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this podcast is just me pumping my bags.
Yeah. You know? That's all we're doing.
Yeah, that's
here.
All we're doing. The Hell Money Bag Pumping podcast. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. It's really hard to say. I think, you know, Namecoin, I would put that as a really sincere project.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to do something really different. It was, I don't know how much innovation there was, but you know, they were innovating. It turned out to be unsuccessful. You know, I have no problem with projects like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would sort of put Ethereum also in a way in this latter category. Ethereum has a huge number of problems, a lot of problems, making it ultimately, I would say, unsuccessful for a lot of the things that I would like it to be successful for. But it was something in this early altcoin period, I think 2014 or so, that came out of it and was trying to do something very different. It was like a whole cloth re-implementation. It wasn't a clone of the Bitcoin blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
Early altcoins, I would say, sort of includes Ethereum, because Ethereum was relatively early.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
Next, we get to the ICO boom in 2017.
What is ICO?
Initial coin offering.
Okay.
Yep. So just people like making a token and selling it. In the 2011 to 2017 early altcoin period, in order to launch an altcoin, you had to clone the Bitcoin software repository,
mm-hmm.
make your
Git clone.
Git clone, yeah. make your trivial modifications to the code, and then compile it and like run it yourself. You'd have to run it. You'd have to get a computer to run it. You'd have to get servers to run it. You would have to get your users to download different software and run that software. The big difference with the ICO boom is that now that Ethereum existed, you could just write a Solidity contract, an Ethereum smart contract, and deploy it to Ethereum, and you didn't need to run any computers anywhere.
So Ethereum is responsible for this.
In a lot of ways, yeah. It lowered the bar. Like, even these early altcoins, like, yeah, you needed to, like, deploy it. There was an ongoing expense to running it.
Right.
If users didn't run your coin, if miners didn't mine it, it was just dead. It just go away. Right. Whereas with Ethereum, you just like write this smart contract, you deploy it to Ethereum, and then it never goes away. And you never need to run a server that keeps it running or, you know, whatever.
Damn.
Yeah. And so the ICO boom is all about people writing white papers, like writing a PDF document that described how incredible their coin was, writing an ERC-20 contract on Ethereum that often didn't do anything at all but create a bunch of tokens. And then sell it to people in some sort of crowd sale.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was all about white papers. I actually, with a friend who shall remain anonymous, we made a joke ICO at this time called Synthorn, which was synthetic rhino horn dick pills on the blockchain.
I love this feature.
Yeah. There was a company called Pembient that was launching PembyCoin. Each Pembi coin was redeemable for 1 gram of synthetic rhino horn. And it was a noble project. This was an ICO, a noble project to like stop rhino horn poaching by flooding the market with synthetic rhino horn. But so me and my friend, just to troll people, made this like, no, we're going to make a derivative. We're going to buy Pembi coin. And then everybody loves rhino horn dick pills. So we're going to make synthetic rhino horn dick pills. And the funny thing is that everything in this ICO boom was so insane that people took our shit seriously. They thought it was real. They didn't think that it was like a joke.
And how was the response then?
Some people were like, this is moronic. Some people were like, I want to invest. Blockchain skeptics were like, oh, like, look at how dumb cryptocurrency is.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
These like bros are like, you know, there's this guy named David Gerard who is sort of like a blockchain skeptic and critic. And he just swallowed it like entirely. He was like, look at the rhino dick pills. Yeah. he was like, he didn't see that it was like an elaborate joke and was like, look at the new depths that the cryptocurrency bros are going to, you know?
Yeah.
We never sold it. Like we never, like when people started saying like, oh, I want to invest that, I was like, this is too real. Like
this is going to pull the plug.
Yeah. And like all these. Yeah, so another problem is a cultural problem. Like, why did this ICO boom happen on Ethereum? And it's that the Ethereum project itself was a token sale. They pre-sold a whole bunch of tokens before anything existed for Bitcoin. And I don't remember how much. I think maybe it was like a 70% of the total supply was pre-mined. And so they had completely normalized selling tokens, one, selling tokens, and two, selling tokens when you didn't actually have anything ready. So that creates this like toxic rot that infects the Ethereum community to this day.
So, okay, like I hear that and I'm like, how did Vitalik justify this like to himself?
Well, let's get to Vitalik in a second.
Okay.
We're almost done crypto history. Yeah. We'll get to the crypto
psychology.
I'm like,
give
archetype.
Me yeah. the crypto psychology archetype.
Yeah, you love
archetypes.
It, chomping at the bit. Yeah. So Ethereum had this toxic rot that they couldn't say like, oh, like our zero value, our like cash grab was okay, but don't fall for this cash grab, guys. Like they were just totally.
And they made it so easy.
Yeah, they made it so easy. Yeah. And even like I've used the phrase pre-mining a few times. Mm-hmm. So it used to be in the early altcoin period that it was bad to have a coin that was pre-mined in that it had a substantial like reward for the developers, because Bitcoin had been a fair launch.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, and all that means is just like the thing launches and then everyone gets a go at it, rather than like before the thing launches,
the you insiders.
And all your bros get, you know, whatever percentage off.
Yeah. So you can
see now that's like norm for altcoins.
The norm. Yeah. And so you can see the cultural difference. In the early altcoin period, a lot of altcoins were like, oh yeah, this is a fair launch with no pre-mine.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously there were some coins that pre-mined, but it was like a negative.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the ICO boom, everything was pre-mined. It was the norm. It had been made the cultural norm. Nobody complained that a project was pre-mined. Even the term pre-mine fell out of use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next period is like 2020 DeFi and NFTs. Basically DeFi, we'll get to the specifics of what's wrong with DeFi, but most DeFi projects essentially just have Ponzi scheme economics wrapped up in a different form. Basically.
Yeah, the pump and dump.
The pump and dump, yeah. That.
I think it's so funny that, like, I mean, who allowed them to call themselves decentralized finance? Like, who?
I mean, like, just took a break from sucking their own dick and they were like, I know, decentralized finance.
Like truly.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm meeting all these fucking blockchain people. Like, I feel like there were a lot of people who were very into DeFi because they thought it was, like, they were like, oh, decentralized finance, that is a social good. Like, they equate those terms, you know?
Right,
like,
absolutely.
Decentralized finance is going to feed Africa, you guys. Like, that's the way they think about it. It's so fucking nuts. And I'm like...
Yeah, like, Africans need, like, I don't know, they need to get a loan, like, a crypto collateralized loan so that they can go yield farming.
No,
like, that's going to save Africa.
It's insane. And it's just, I don't understand, like, and I think it is maybe just people are so manipulated by marketing or whatever, but I feel like even the fact that they get to be like, and we're the DeFi ecosystem, like, it really does bring a lot of people in.
And that's it's another thing, like, you know, my objections with DeFi are technical. They're not that, like, it'd be great if we could really decentralize finance, but what DeFi does is not actually what people think about as finance.
No.
So NFTs, I have a soft spot for NFTs, not most NFTs. Like, I fundamentally think it's fine to be like, okay, I'm gonna make a digital bauble and I'm gonna sell it. But the reason that what's wrong with NFTs is people wildly overestimate what they can do. They're thinking it's going to be like the next phase of culture. Everything is going to be an NFT.
Yeah.
And that's just completely wrong. Like, NFTs are going to be a minor thing for collectors and artists. And that's it.
Like, there's always going to be people who are into collecting. And I think that there will always be like a niche for that.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a lot of people who are banking on this really insane dystopic view of the future where it's like, well, you guys, you don't realize that in 10 years, like, a piece of the metaverse is going to be worth more than a house.
Right.
And it's like, what?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, come on, don't put your money into that future.
And it's also similar to what you sort of said about the blockchain. Like, not everything needs a blockchain. Not everything needs to be an NFT.
No.
You don't need your, like, you don't want anything to be an NFT. So it's just like massive overestimation of what these two things can do.
Yeah.
DeFi and NFTs. Most people not technical enough to see any difference.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where we are today.
Yep. That's where we are today. That brings us to the present
day. But,
you know,
I do think, like, we are seeing a purge right now, obviously, with, like, the prices all being down, you know?
Yeah. There's a bit of a purge. Like, people are getting wrecked, you know? But this stuff is, you know, one thing is that this stuff is never going to go away in the same reason that, like, casinos don't go away.
Yeah.
DeFi, altcoins, ICOs, NFTs. If you zoom out and kind of, like, abstract over the details, they function as a sort of big, weird casino.
Yeah.
And people go to casinos. And so for the same reason that Las Vegas is never going to go away, crypto degeneracy is never going to go away.
Yeah. I mean, it did. I feel like that was something that clicked for me where I realized, like, okay, trading is not something I want to do anymore, which is just that, like, I mean, maybe not my specific profits, but, like, in general, profits rely on, like, there being a bag holder. It is a Ponzi scheme.
Well, it depends on the, you know? It depends on what you're trading, right? Like, if you buy Apple stock and like Apple becomes valuable because it makes a lot of computers that are super useful. Like that's not really
I meant crypto trading.
Oh yeah, crypto trading. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. It's all like greater
fun. But that was like a phase for me.
Yeah. Oh, did you have a degen crypto trading phase?
Yeah, dude.
Oh, I didn't know this.
You didn't know
this
that?
This is a confession. Yeah, oh, live yeah. confession on yeah. air.
Well, because, okay, so my excuse for it is I grew up playing Neopets,
mm-hmm.
and Neopets had like a very degenerate stock market ecosystem.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if you played
no.
it ever.
What did they trade? Did they trade pets or pet accessories?
Well, you had to... You got Neo points, like that was the currency of Neopets, uh-huh. but they had a stock market that was like just literal random, like so you would put your money in and then like all of a sudden like your random paintbrush stock would like uh-huh. go up so much, then you cash out and like you could use that to buy like cool things for your pets or like uh-huh. whatever.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
it just, I feel like growing up doing that, I kind of like learned how to like gamify money.
Right. Yeah.
And so then crypto is just like, if you have like the emotional removal required to like be a very zen trader, mm-hmm. it's like not that hard to do well, like when the market's only up. You
yeah,
know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
So I did that for a while. And it's, you know, a good way to supplement grad student
mm-hmm.
salary.
Yeah.
But now I feel like
you a double portion of ramen.
Yeah. It's crazy. But yeah, I mean, I think like, it was becoming a Bitcoiner that made me kind of realize that that's like somewhat immoral. It's like not.
I mean, is it immoral to go to a casino and win against somebody else in poker?
No, but it's just, I just don't. Yeah, it's not even it's immoral. It's just I don't want to like do it. You know, it's not like fun. It just feels like kind of dark and
totally.
I'm just like not into it anymore. I mean, that being said, like I still have my various bags. I'm waiting to like sell off for Bitcoin at some point, but it is just like. Yeah, it's such a fucking shit show.
Yeah,
it's totally. Such a mess. And it really like disturbed me how many people that are into trading, like I was like, I don't think you even know.
Mm-hmm.
You're recommending this to people. You don't even like know what it
right.
is, you know, and such a crazy. And there's also like with the pre-mine stuff, like influencers get paid off to like promote certain things. And like, it is true if you get in at the right time, like sometimes you can just make like a ton of money, you know, but yeah, so I definitely had a degen phase, but you know, we're moving past it. Now we're in our hard money phase.
Hard money phase. Yeah, totally.
Now that I've talked about my dark psychology.
Yeah. No, yeah, a lot of people have that. You know what I mean? Like, and I think the understanding is like, yeah, it's a casino, it's fun, but like, there's no value creation. And like, I think the thing that makes it really dark is if you're going in there being like, oh, this is a casino, that's fine. But then there's some people going in there like, no, this is a legitimate opportunity. And when you win against them, it sucks.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what I mean. It felt a little bit... Yeah. And I feel like I would like interact with people that were so young and like just didn't even know. Like it... Yeah. I feel like money psychology, like personal finance psychology in general is really hard. Like I feel like I have a good zen emotional removal that allows me to do that kind of thing. But a lot of people, it gets like... tied up in their shit in a way that's really difficult.
Yeah. I never have really went through a trading phase because I'm really bad at it. Everything that I bought aside from Bitcoin. Actually, no, I think I bought some Ethereum really early and I made a lot of money off of it. I mean, not a lot.
Yeah,
but I made like
gains.
A tiny little sum.
Percentage wise.
Yeah.
Lots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
it's all about those percent gains, man.
Yeah.
You know?
But aside from that, I mean, like I lost money on IOTA. Just like shameful shitcoin.
Yeah.
I like read the white paper. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I bought some. And then I thought about it a lot. And then I was like, no, this is never going to work. And I wrote this super long paper about why it was bad. And then I shorted it. And then I released the paper and I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And then it just like spiked and I lost a bunch of money. It was bad. So I lost money longing it and then lost money shorting it, which is like pretty shameful.
Yeah. No, you don't have, that's why I said I was the finance bro of the pod. Cause you,
oh yeah, for
you
sure.
Don't have, I'm definitely like the degen.
Yeah.
You're like the Milton Friedman economics, Chicago boy,
right.
Finance bro of the pod, but I'm the degenerate trader.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll manage the hell money finances.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Put
it
all in shit coins.
Right.
Okay. So can we get to my awaited part of the pod?
Crypto psychological archetypes.
Yeah. Why does this happen?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So
yeah, I divided into three categories: grifters, astronauts, and the hoi polloi.
Okay.
Who first?
Go with grifters. I feel like that's the easiest to understand.
Yeah, super easy to understand. They're just people who see a money-making opportunity, and they see that nobody actually understands what they're buying, right? Nobody understands cryptocurrencies. I talk to, like, hardcore Ethereum bros and Ethereum devs, like, who would describe themselves as, oh, I'm an Ethereum dev. And then after 5 minutes of conversation, I realize they don't understand how Ethereum works at all.
Yeah.
They haven't thought of really basic things about Ethereum and how Bitcoin and Ethereum are different. Like, they don't get it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, grifters just, like, see that everybody doesn't understand anything and, like, just, like, lie. And, like, the grifter par excellence is somebody who participated in the ICO boom, who just, like, writes a white paper, puts it up on the web, gets a bunch of money, and then is living to this day on, like, a small Caribbean island on a beach.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that definitely also, like, in the most recent 2020 sort of, like, NFT boom, that describes a lot of, like, YouTubers and influencers and stuff. Absolutely. Like that, who got, like, yeah. They were like, yeah, I'm dropping this NFT collection, yeah, or, like, I'm, yeah, promoting this coin that, mm-hmm, I was, like, paid, yeah, to promote, yeah, and whatever. All, yeah, this. There's definitely, like, yeah, I feel like with how widespread things got in, like, 2020, 2021, mm-hmm, the grifter part got huge, like, yeah, just, like, mass scale. And that was, like, a lot of, like, I mean, the YouTuber influencer part was, like, literally, yeah, selling to children.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. And a lot of these people, it's weird. Like, a lot of these people probably have convinced themselves that what they're doing is, like, reasonable or, like, correct or,
well,
moral.
I think, like, the way that I see it is, like, it's not that different than how, like, a lot of crony capitalism already works. Mm-hmm. It's just, like, yeah, I guess, like, just thinking about, like, my own sort of, like, switch from being, like, a degen trader to, like, not really doing that anymore is, like, that I feel like once I realized that Bitcoin was, like, a way out of the current financial system, I was, mm-hmm, like, well, why would I do anything?
Yeah,
like,
right,
why would I participate in anything else? Yeah, like, yeah, if I could get out of crony capitalism, why, yeah, would I not do
and
that?
Bitcoin,
but I think it's easy to justify if you don't see it that way or you don't,
absolutely,
understand that.
Yeah.
And, like, it's easy to just be like, well, the rich do this, the, yeah, people at the top do this, the government does this. Where's my piece of the pie?
Right.
You,
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah,
maybe it's not that they justify it in a way of, like, this is good or whatever. I think on the grifter part, at least, there's, mm-hmm, there's a lot of people who, like, mental gymnastics themselves, right, into thinking that what they're doing is morally good. But I think grifter's going to grift,
yeah,
you know? And it's,
yeah,
a grifting economy at, mm-hmm, this point.
Right, yeah.
So they're just,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
getting,
yeah,
in where they see opportunity.
Yeah, get in where you fit in.
Yeah,
yeah,
you know? And in some ways, I can't blame them for that. Like, okay, so we got the grifters. That's, mm-hmm, easy to conceptualize. And I think a lot of people think, like, all of crypto is grifters, so...
Right.
You know?
Totally. Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Then the astronauts.
Yep. So then we've got astronauts. So this is a really interesting category. This is sort of like a sort of, like, common failure mode of technical, sophisticated people that I have sort of noticed all throughout crypto. Astronauts are people who really underestimate... I mean, like, astronaut philosophizer, there's, like, yeah, there's a lot of subcategories here, but, like, these are people who really underestimate the cost of complexity. They see some problem with Bitcoin or some social problem or some greater, you know, whatever in the world, some ill of the world that they want to solve. And they think, ah, like, I'll come up with this. I have this, like, solution, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, oh, the solution has a few little problems, right? And they think, ah, oh, no, I'll paper over that with these other problems. We'll do this other thing,
mm-hmm,
you know, that will make those problems go away. And then, ah, there are these, like, other problems that are come from the fix that to the original problems. And then, oh, no, we'll just do this and this little other thing. And then pretty soon they're just, like, you know, at the controls of this, like, Howl's Moving Castle monstrosity that's, like, creaking through the landscape, and you're like, this shit is gonna fall over. This is a fucking disaster. This,
yeah,
is a fire hazard. Like, this is bad. And yeah, and this is Vitalik. Like,
yeah,
Vitalik is the astronaut. He has created a wildly complex system with huge amounts of problems, and continues to sort of be an apologist for it. To be like, oh, like, Ethereum doesn't scale, but we're going to do this crazy ass shit to make it scale.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of succession of Ethereum scaling technologies has been totally absurd. They've gone from, like, sharding to state channels, to Plasma, to Plasma Cash, to rollups, to, like, they, you know, and all these, none of these things have worked. And they're like, oh, no, like, yeah, the next thing, this is going to be the thing. that works.
I think like that ideology of like, I mean, essentially I feel like it boils down to like, there can be a technical solution to any, like eventually we'll innovate. I feel like Elon Musk falls into this category as well. Like, I feel like the way Elon, and I think it benefits him a lot in terms of like the success of his business.
But
I feel like he's another, I mean, Elon Musk like literally believes in Dogecoin.
Yeah, it's
you know?
Yeah, I have trouble putting Elon Musk into this category because like, because essentially some of his businesses like this, they're so simple. Like, I mean, Starship is just like a big, you know, like steel tube filled with jet fuel that he's going to launch in the atmosphere. Tesla are just like, they're just electric cars that are pretty nice.
But like the idea we're going to go to Mars, for example, like he's just like, doesn't matter the problems. We're going to figure them out. Well, of course we'll figure them out.
Sure.
You know, humanity progresses, whatever. Right. And like, I think that there's something to be said for that perspective in terms of like driving optimism and innovation. Like you do need some level of optimism, like whether it's like scientific, technical, whatever, like kind of optimism, belief that like the problems can be solved. But I kind of feel like, you know, it's like the, there's no chemical solution to a spiritual problem. Like if something doesn't work on like a deeper level, like there is a solution, but it's not just increasing technological specificity, band-aid on top of the thing. Maybe you got to shake up the whole paradigm, take a step back or something, you know?
There's another category that I just thought of, which is the, it's basically, I don't know what to call these people, or maybe I'd call them idealists. They're people who confuse is and ought. These are people who decide that like, oh, well, the world ought to be this way, so we can create things that like solve those problems. Instead of just sticking to like a descriptive description of what the world is, they see like, ah, there's inequality, so we're going to make a blockchain that fixes inequality. And they go, well, this will work, or it must work, because inequality must be solved. This is another sort of archetype. I went to, worst example, I went to an early like 2014, I don't remember when it was. I went to a presentation. Actually, no, it was ICO boom. So it was 2016 or 2017 by an outfit called the Economic Space Agency. And they gave this like hour long like presentation about like what they were doing. And it was clear that like they had no fucking idea what they were doing. And they were these like political like philosophy theorists who like had gotten confused and like some of them could program. And like, it was baffling.
What were they trying to do?
No. Like at the end of the, nobody knew. At the end of the hour long presentation, somebody literally asked the question of like, so like, what are you doing? And they just gave this like evasive like answer. And then we all went to dinner afterwards and I was sitting next to one of them and I said like, so like what, like I basically rephrased it in other words. Like, yeah, what are you guys doing exactly? And the guy turned to me and he was like, what do you think we should do?
Yeah.
Like, and it was just, yeah.
But that's a lot of, I mean, yeah, the blockchain people I met, a lot of them. I mean, I was talking to a fucking CEO who literally, like, I asked him a question and he said, I will pay you to figure that out for me.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're 23.
You're sitting here, whatever, you're like 25 or 26.
But I'm not a CEO of a blockchain company, you know? Like, it was just like, damn, bro. Like, yeah, it's, but see that, I think that is like psychological manipulation. I don't think those people necessarily know that they're grifting or that they, like, I think it's like they've gotten in too deep. I also think like there's a lot of people who just don't have like a right or wrong compass. And like those people would just go work in finance normally. You know what I mean? They would just go work for a hedge fund and never question themselves. But because like crypto is this new thing, instead of going into finance, they're like, I'm going to go into crypto. I'm going to go into blockchain. And it's like, it's the same level of like weird psychopathic, almost like level of removal from what you do and what you're even fucking talking about.
Psychopathic sounds good. Like naturopathic, like you can't use pathic with psycho, like psychotic, like just absolutely.
But
like,
it's psychopath behavior.
But that sounds good. I want to buy like natural
being psychopath. Being a psychopath is not a good
thing. Being a psychopath is bad, but psychopathic That sounds like some nice psychopathic.
What about sociopath?
Sociopath. No, no. Yeah, just sociopath.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But it is. It's like being like emotionally removed from what you're doing, or like unable to engage on like a moral, emotional level with like what you're doing, saying, or being.
Yeah. Another problem these people have is they don't understand how difficult the problems that they're trying to solve are.
Yeah.
That they're like, you know, these are the deep abiding mysteries of distributed systems and computer science. Like, you can't just like sit down and like just bust one out over the afternoon in your text editor and like solve these problems.
People also make themselves feel better because they're like, well, nobody really understands it, which is like true in their world, you know? Like,
Bitcoiners understand it. Talk to Bitcoiners about how Bitcoin works and the trade-off involved. Like, sophisticated Bitcoiners, like, we fucking understand
it. I know, that's
it.
What I love about Bitcoiners. Yeah. They're real nerds, you know?
Yeah.
But I think if you're in a situation where you're getting paid so much money and everyone around you is like, dude, it's cool. Don't have imposter syndrome. Like, we don't get it either. It's all okay. And we're still making millions of dollars. Yeah, like, we're changing the world. Like, it's like, it's very easy to convince yourself that that is normal.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I feel like there's these people who are like the astronaut types that they are like idealistic and like, maybe they are thinking about the problems at some level of depth and they're just like, no, we will progress past them.
Right.
But I feel like there's a lot of people who are sort of like, just like socially manipulated into never really like reconciling with the deeper things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we get into the hoi polloi.
Yeah. The hoi polloi, the rabble. Yeah. I would call them the plebs, but like.
They're not pleb, but they
Bitcoin,
could be.
Because plebs are now like, they're big. A pleb is a Bitcoiner.
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, the hoi polloi, the rabble, the normal
people. It's like 4chan guys.
Yeah, and also just, like, you know, somebody who, like, saw it in their Robinhood account. Like, I feel so bad for people who, like, go to Coinbase and then they see all these cryptocurrencies and it says Bitcoin, Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash. And they don't understand that they're not all the same. Yeah. You know what I mean? That it's like they think it's like a stock market where there's, like good there's a bunch of good companies in this category. And they can go pick the good companies. And it's like, no, there's the good thing, which is Bitcoin. It's like, there's the real market, which is Bitcoin. And then there's the casinos, which is everything else. And they see this like false equivalence between them.
But I think they also, I mean, talking to a lot of people who are younger than me, a lot of them, I remember I was talking to this guy who's an Ethereum Solidity developer who's 21.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you're the youngest person I've ever met that's a Bitcoin person.
Oh yeah, right.
Uh-huh. And he was like, I was like, well, why aren't, you know, I was just trying to figure out like, why aren't you? And I mean, it was a lot of reasons we've already sort of discussed about just not really understanding what he was doing and just kind of, but a lot of it was, he was like, well, I missed the boat. Like, you know, the time to make money on Bitcoin is already passed.
Right.
So I got to find the next Bitcoin.
Right.
It's like this idea that like, we're just going to have the next Bitcoin.
Right. Yeah. Know? And like,
and you're betting on the next Bitcoin essentially.
Right. Essentially. Yeah. And there's no reason to believe that there will be another Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right. It's like seeing the internet and being like, oh, like, yeah, there's going to be another internet that's better and we should go work on that. And it's like, no, you should probably just work on the internet. And like, yeah, it's true. Maybe you did miss the boat a little bit, but that doesn't mean that like, you know, there's an answer to that. Like, the answer to that is like, well, okay, so first off, you didn't miss the boat. Bitcoin is going to easy 10x from here. Easy 10x. No problem.
From here. I mean, from here. Come on.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, we're in the shitter right now. But then also, there's so many opportunities that aren't just related to speculation. Like, do a startup, do a cool Bitcoin company. Like, you don't need, you do something useful on Bitcoin.
But there's not as much around Bitcoin either. Like, I think, you know, a lot of like the younger people that are like going into like cryptocurrency, blockchain development, like they're just looking for a job, you know?
Oh, sure,
and there's all these companies that have way too much venture capital or whatever kind of money to just hire Berkeley computer science majors to do whatever. And there's not that much on Bitcoin. Like, it's just not the same.
I mean, there's entrepreneurial opportunities on Bitcoin, and a lot of them are not really crypto opportunities. If somebody was like, oh, I want to do something, thinking about like Bitcoin or crypto, what should I do? I would probably say like, yeah, think of an interesting thing that you could do with Lightning. Lightning is like fast, internet native, digital payments. And so there's a lot of interesting things that you can do with it. Like, you can do like social media plus Lightning. Lightning is something you can do. We sort of said, yeah, you can't just do X plus blockchain, but a lot of the time you can do X plus Bitcoin, right? Think about like, okay, well, you know, social media has likes and it has problems with spam likes. Like, make people pay for likes. Make people, like, reward people with sats per likes for likes. do some sort of business that couldn't exist without a payment network like Lightning. That's sort of, I'd say, where the big opportunities are.
But these people aren't trying to start a crypto company or a company or be an entrepreneur. They're trying to just get a salaried job.
Just suckle at crypto mommy GF's teat.
Yeah, well, it's just like, I feel like it is the new, I mean, like most Berkeley computer science or most Berkeley undergrads are computer science majors. And
most Berkeley undergrads. It's probably not statistically true.
That's true.
Most Berkeley undergrads are computer science
or majors. At least they come in as freshmen. It's like 60% of freshmen come in with the intention of being computer science majors. Yeah, dude, it's big.
That's insane. I had no idea.
Wow. Okay. So it's like, I think it's like, I feel like pre-med and finance and all these like majors that like previously, like your parents pushed you to do them and you said, okay, I'm going to do this because I'm going to get a job. Mm-hmm. That's computer science.
Wow.
Now.
Okay. That's
I mean,
crazy.
Think about it. It's tech and how big it is, especially here.
And
it's,
I mean, the amount of money you can make is insane.
It's exactly. Bonkers. Exactly. And so like, I think there's a lot of people, young people who just go into this and they just want jobs. They just want to work in it. And then they do end up having these like very high up roles at these like insane startup crypto companies, you know? They don't even own any cryptocurrency.
They're like Robinhood account.
Yeah. They're just trying to like get a salary job have a nice apartment, you know? It's like, okay. If you're like trying to be like a visionary, like then maybe you can do some sort of Bitcoin entrepreneurial startup thing. But I just think it's like, it's just an area of tech that has way too much money and like people just will always flock to money. Free market, you know?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm like a free market guy. There is a massive overallocation of money in crypto. Like there's money that's just being burnt. I wish it wasn't, but that's the way it is. Sometimes the market is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Casey. Sometimes the market is wrong. I wish Milton Friedman was alive to hear you say
Often the market is wrong. But I think that usually when the government tries to fix the market, it's worse. Like, I'll take the market being wrong over, like, the moronic state, the jackboot of the state trying to fix the market, right?
All hail the market, right?
Yeah.
What the invisible hand says.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, we got derailed. What should we... can we go through specifically what's wrong with all of these cryptos?
Yeah.
Because I need that. I think the listeners, the viewers...
The listeners need it. Yeah. Let's just pick them. Like, pick... What do you want to hear first?
I mean, Ethereum is obviously... Like, I need to know what's up with Ethereum.
Okay, yeah. So, I kind of... Yeah, so massive pre-mine, right? Mm-hmm. They, like, pre-mine 70% of their supply.
Right, so they kind of fucked up their karma from the beginning.
Fucked up their karma from the beginning. This means that the community is completely... Totally... community tolerates tokenization. Everything in Ethereum gets tokenized. Bitcoin Lightning came along, and then Ethereum said, okay, we're going to do our Lightning competitor, and it's called Raiden. And Raiden is essentially like Lightning for Ethereum. And Raiden immediately issues a token because there's no immune response to tokens, to people issuing tokens, which is a huge problem with Ethereum. Everything on Ethereum, every single scaling solution with Ethereum, you know, now we have like Optimism and whatever, they all have tokens. They're all, they tolerate this like cash grab mentality.
Right.
And it's not just that it's a cash grab, it's that it makes things worse. Like imagine if you had to get Bitcoin plus like Lightning token in order to use the Lightning network.
Yeah, it's insane.
It would make it worse. It'd make it harder to use, etc.
Yeah. I mean, and like, what is like the possible like future with that? Like you have a wallet and you have 100 different tokens in it.
Right.
Like,
I mean, that's not the future of Ethereum. That's the present of Ethereum.
Right. But that's like, yeah, what is the like end vision?
Game. Yeah.
Right.
That oftentimes that is the Ethereum end game vision. Ethereum people in the Ethereum ecosystem are like, oh yeah, you're gonna have a token for everything. You're gonna have like an Amazon token. You're gonna have like an electricity company token. And it's like, no, you kind of only need one token. It's called money and you use it to pay for things. And the utility of money comes from being able to pay from many different things. It's like they exist in this like digital barter reality where like somehow like, no, we need, there were issues with barter, but we need to solve the issues with barter. Somehow it's like, no, we solved them. It's called money. It's great. Bitcoin's great money. Just use that.
Yeah. So the token situation.
Yeah. The scaling, I have this down as scaling comedy. So just the whole path of Ethereum scaling, like Ethereum does not scale. When you're doing computation on a blockchain. So this is kind of complicated, but like, okay, you have this blockchain. it needs to be decentralized. Different people need to be able to run the blockchain. So you sort of need to limit how much contracts can do, smart contracts can do, in order to keep it reasonably decentralized and reasonably cheap to run. Ethereum already fails at that. It's incredibly expensive to run. It's hundreds of gigabytes of state and like growing much faster than Bitcoin is growing. So it's going to be a terabyte. It's going to be 2 terabytes. Ethereum basically has the power. People talk about Ethereum as like the world computer. It doesn't have the power of a computer. It's about as powerful. It's like less powerful than a cell phone, like legitimately way less powerful than a single cell phone. So everybody's trying to run programs. I mean, it's like, I wonder which cell phone, like it's probably less powerful than an original Apple phone. It's probably like a Nokia or some shit. So everybody's bidding to run their smart contracts with transaction fees on this like one Nokia, right? So then transaction fees get insanely expensive.
And that's the Ethereum gas fees that everyone is complaining about all the time.
Yeah.
I can't believe that people just would trade through that and not.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, they
how
will.
How did people not like realize, like, if I'm paying tens of thousands of dollars trading fees, this is like not normal.
If you're paying thousands of dollars in trading fees, but you think you can make tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
You'll do it. Yeah. You'll do it. You're a rational actor. Yeah. So Ethereum has kind of known this from the beginning that it doesn't scale. So they've always had this like scaling roadmap, but that they have not had a scaling roadmap that they are delivering on and following and going from stage to stage on a scaling roadmap. It's sort of been like the initial idea was sharding, that you were going to have multiple Ethereum chains that all talked to each other. But then it kind of became clear that that didn't work. And we went through a phase that was sort of abandoned. Now there was a phase that, oh, we're going to do these things called state channels. We're sort of going to have a lightning kind of scaling solution. A lightning-like solution doesn't really work on Ethereum because, I mean, for complicated reasons, but you can't just do the Ethereum degen shit that you want on channels. Then there was like the Plasma phase where there was the solution called Plasma where we're going to have this like hierarchical hierarchy of like many lightweight blockchains that could all talk to each other. That kind of didn't work. Then there was Plasma Cash, which was like a variation of Plasma. And like at each stage in this process, everybody was wholly bought in that this was the thing that was going to scale Ethereum.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not like, it's like, yeah, there was a period where people really thought that sharding was the thing. There's a period where people really thought that state channels was the thing. Plasma Cash.
And now it's proof of stake.
Yeah, proof of stake doesn't actually really even scale Ethereum very much. Mm-hmm. It's not a scaling technology. Right now it's really rollups. It's optimistic rollups and zero knowledge rollups, which are kind of a joke. It's basically that you're gonna do all this computation off chain, and then you're gonna submit this like one big transaction that commits to all of that computation on the Ethereum main chain.
Mm-hmm.
The current things that are rolled out are not secure. There's something called Optimism. I found out recently that Optimism has no fraud proofs, so Optimism is based on optimistic rollups. You have this like operator of the rollup who like combines all these transactions together and executes them hopefully faithfully and then submits them to the main chain. But there's this period where anybody is supposed to be able to sort of challenge what they posted to the main chain and go like, in like step like 952, you didn't do this right. You did something like fishy. And then they're supposed to be able to like slash them and like everybody can exit the rollup or whatever. This is what keeps it secure. Optimism has like billions of dollars in it. I don't know if it's a billion or multiple billions or 700 million or whatever it is. It doesn't have fraud proofs. It's basically like a mini Ethereum running on one computer in somebody's basement with no protections whatsoever, like zero decentralization. And people are like, oh, this is the future. So like they have no credible scaling story. They've gone from like hopium to hopium to hopium. Everything that they're pursuing comes with massive costs that are underappreciated that are going to make it worse. Yeah, the scaling is just a joke. Ethereum is never going to scale. Then there's we talked about this, the massive pre-mine. This is actually a huge problem if they're going to transition to proof of stake. So in proof of work, token holders and miners are independent entities that to some extent keep each other in check.
Mm-hmm.
proof of stake merges the miners and the token holders. They're just validators now. Anybody who has tokens can create blocks.
Right. So, like, okay, maybe I'll try to put this in layman's terms and you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But, like, with proof of work, it's that you're putting in computational power in order to, like, secure the network or to
verify transactions. Really. You're buying energy. Yeah.
Right. Energy is being exchanged for transactions on the network.
Mm-hmm.
But then for proof of stake, it's that you have tokens and whoever has the most tokens.
Right.
Whereas, like, for the proof of work, whoever has the most energy would be like who has the most power, right? And so it's hard to amass huge amounts of energy. You can't.
Yeah. There's an open market for energy.
I mean, we know how easy it is to amass huge amounts of money.
Right.
You know?
Yep. And it's like, well, let's say that there was somebody who owned like 50% of the Bitcoin. Let's say there's somebody who owns 60% of the Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That'd be bad, but it'd kind of be bad for like economic reasons. Maybe they're going to dump on the market unpredictably. Like that kind of be bad, but dealable, right?
It doesn't like corrupt the functioning of Bitcoin.
Very functioning of Bitcoin itself. No, it doesn't. It kind of has problems for the economic side of Bitcoin.
Right.
Ethereum, if post proof of stake transition, if there's a Ethereum holder who has 70% of the coins post proof of stake transition, that is a major security problem. That means that that one person can decide which transactions get mined and don't get mined.
And the rich get richer. It's like absolutely. You have the most tokens to stake and then you get more transactions, which then means you can mine more. Like, it's just, I don't understand why anybody thinks that system works.
No. Yeah. I call it the stake ratchet. Did we talk about this a little bit?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. Yeah. So this is just an analogy between proof of stake and the tool, a ratchet, right?
I'm sorry. Just you explaining.
Am I a joke? Am I a joke to you? Listen, I'm trying to break this down. All right. So, like,
go on.
Okay, so what does proof of stake have to do with a ratchet?
Yeah.
So basically, a ratchet only goes one way. And if you try to move it the other direction, it resists moving in that direction. So this is kind of like centralization on a proof of stake chain. It, unlike mining, where it takes a constant input of electricity and thus resources to continue mining, it doesn't cost anything to keep staking Ethereum and to get those block rewards and those transaction fees. And so what that means is that if you have like 10% of the Ethereum, if you want to keep having 10% of the Ethereum, you just have to run a validator, which costs nothing, right? So nobody kind of push you off of the network, right? You just run your validator and you'll get 10% of the block rewards and 10% of the fees, and you'll stay at 10% of the network in perpetuity. Unlike in Bitcoin mining, where somebody can come and challenge you, put in more electricity, and take your share of the network. You can't just sit there. You have to continue fighting, right? And so in that way, I think proof of stake is like a ratchet. The centralizing properties of like a proof of stake are like a ratchet. If it just has this push that it just has this way that it resists decentralization and it doesn't resist further centralization. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is really underappreciated and is like a major thing that is obvious and that these people don't. They discount it entirely.
I don't think they understand the political side of it.
Absolutely not.
They're just, again, it's like, well, but like we have a technical problem, which is all the energy usage. So we need to fix it by changing it.
Yep.
It's like, okay, but then there's no point of it at all.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Then just don't have a blockchain at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then finally, what's wrong with Ethereum? Like, all the contracts are so insecure. Like, it's just a fucking disaster. Like, there's a site called rec.news. They stopped posting things recently, but like, there's massive hacks all the time of Ethereum contracts. It's like you get these, like, frankly, like unintelligent, unserious, poor developers writing these like complicated financial systems, financial, you know, widgets that have very tricky semantics, and they don't get them right, and then they just get like hacked. And this is a consequence both of the low quality of development, the sort of YOLO like kind of community energy, and also that Solidity, the programming language, and EVM, the sort of virtual machine of Ethereum, are not made carefully. There's a sort of an upgrade to Bitcoin scripting language called Simplicity, which is made very carefully. It has this like care in mind. And it's just at the opposite spectrum of Solidity. And you would definitely call Simplicity, the Bitcoin scripting upgrade, those are smart contracts. But they're just with an entirely different level of like care, and Solidity doesn't have that. Everything gets hacked. It's just, it's a mess. It's crazy how bad the code is for smart contracts, for Ethereum smart contracts. Yeah.
Is that everything?
That's everything.
You got through it all?
Yeah, that's my rant on Ethereum.
That's pretty good. I like that.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah. Okay, so what's next?
Okay, so yeah, Ethereum, so you got through Ethereum.
Got Ethereum.
You're going through your hit list.
Yeah.
Next is DeFi.
Yeah, DeFi is really simple. DeFi is all Ponzi economics, right? Where you it's just this box, and then everybody puts money into the box, right? And they have some claim on like money that they're allowed to take in the box. And people's claim keeps going up and up notationally. They're like rich on paper, but there are more claims than there are dollars in the box. And then when everybody tries to take their dollars, it's all relying on people not taking their dollars out of the box. And then when they do, it collapses. And that's DeFi is just most projects are just a repackaging of Ponzi scheme economics, like flat out.
Yeah.
There's no underlying economic activity. The thing that makes finance writ broad useful is that there are real activities in the real world that finance helps. You're a business owner. You go to get a loan. You open a taco restaurant. You serve people delicious tacos. That loan facilitated the creation of delicious tacos. Or you want to get a car loan, right? You get a loan, you buy a car. Now you have a car. You pay it off. Like, great. In DeFi, it doesn't actually connect to the real world economy. It's all circular, just like off Ouroboros, right? That's the snake eating its own tail. No, Ouroboros.
Yeah, Ouroboros. Yeah, it's all off Ouroboros.
Off Ouroboros, you should know this. It's the snake astrological sign.
Oh, yeah, that's the one
sign.
I had that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ouroboros, just like human snake centipede, astral, like swallowing its own turds, right? Like mm-hmm. That's all DeFi is. It's all circular. There's no connection to real economic activity. It's like pure casino. A lot of the things that finance does that are useful, DeFi cannot do. So, for example, DeFi can't really do loans in a meaningful way. When you go get a home loan or a car loan, let's say you want to borrow $10,000 to get a car. You don't like put anything down against that loan. Mm-hmm. They're just like, yeah, we trust you. We know you. We see your credit. Like, we trust you. We'll give you this $10,000 so that you can buy a car. And like, you don't need to put up $10,000. The only kind of loan that DeFi can do is collateralized lending, where you put up some other asset and then you borrow against that asset.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like not, that's certainly useful, but it's not the most, it doesn't do things like home loans or auto loans or whatever, which are like semi-collateralized, or they're collateralized with a real world asset. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't even do the things that are useful about finance. And then finally, it's just insanely complicated and insecure. I mean, just like so complicated, getting hacked all the time. Nobody audits this stuff. Like, people are morons writing this code, just like keyboard lickers, just like mashing it, just like morons. Yeah. So that's DeFi. Stablecoins. Stablecoins are actually pretty high utility. We talked a lot. Like, people need digital dollars. Digital dollars are useful. But yeah, a lot of the algorithmic stablecoins like Terra Luna. Yeah.
I mean, well, yeah, we all know that now at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure people will continue to get scammed, but
yeah,
there's got to be at least some sort of reckoning.
Yeah. Yeah. But as Bitcoiners, we've got to understand that stablecoins serve a useful functioning. In the pre-hyper Bitcoinization world, people want stable units to transact in. But the best case scenario is basically just digital, private, fully collateralized banks on crypto rails, which is like USDC and Tether. Right? Mm. Those models are like kind of reasonable. Those companies might fail or be bad or whatever, but the model is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Very not Bitcoin maxi of you.
Yeah, no, it's just the reality, you know. Like I mean, for example, like one of the most high volume uses of stablecoins is actually Tether on Tron. Tron is like an eighth tier shitcoin centralized Ethereum competitor, but it has really fast transactions and low transaction fees, and people want to trade Tether, and so it gets used a lot in like remittances and like in Africa and like merchants. Like, some Nigerian wants to buy some like a ton of wheat from somebody in China, and Tether on Tron gives them like fast digital dollars. they're not thinking about centralization or like, yeah. So I think that stuff can move to Bitcoin, but until it does, yeah, there's utility there. Like, right. Hard to argue with that.
Okay.
Yep. Solana, a lot of people ask me about Solana. Solana is just takes a, like, it's like, it is actually maybe about as powerful as a cell phone and like a good cell phone. Wildly centralized, insanely complex, insanely costly to run a full node. It probably takes like a few $1,000s a month to run a Solana full node. Unlike Bitcoin, which you can run on a Raspberry Pi. And I know Anatoly, and I think he's like a good guy and I think he's smart, but I think he just doesn't understand, again, like some of the incentives in play.
Yeah.
Bitcoin, because it's so easy to run a full node, during the block size wars, the Bitcoin users and developers were able to resist the moneyed interests and the interests of miners and essentially defeated them. Solana, because it's centralized and nobody can like verify the chain and it's so costly to run, they could not have resisted that pressure, essentially. Like they are fully at the whim of the miners and the devs. It's just totally centralized. Yep. And feel free to jump in with any questions or comments you have.
No, I'm enjoying. I need that, you know, it's an educational experience.
Okay. NFTs. So this NFTs are like, you know, there's kind of nothing wrong with the core idea of NFTs, but NFTs as they exist are just awful. They're mostly fully centralized. The contracts are complicated. So you have the same like complexity, security, and auditing problem. But the main problem with NFTs is that people way, way, way overestimate what role they're going to play in the future. Like they think that they're going to be like the future of like digital art or like real estate or like everything's going to be an NFT. So yeah.
My question about NFTs is like, okay, so NFTs are done on Ethereum right now, right?
NFTs are kind of done everywhere.
Does Ethereum, that, doesn't Tezos, that et matter? Like, okay, if you have an NFT of mm-hmm. like some, like the Vatican makes NFTs of the various Catholic artifacts and they put it on Ethereum and then Ethereum goes to shit, let's say.
Yeah.
Does the Vatican now make new NFTs on whatever the next NFT thing is? Like, in terms of, like, from the NFT perspective, like, isn't it so reliant on whatever you mint your NFTs on being the thing forever? Or
yeah,
no?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, there's... Yes.
Like, it's not just the value of your NFT, like your Bored Ape or whatever. Yeah, it's also, like, it also means that the thing that you minted the NFT has to succeed and be
absolutely.
Around.
Absolutely. Yep.
That, to me, seems like, at that point, just buy Ethereum or something. You know, if you're already betting on Ethereum on the NFT,
right.
Then wouldn't you just buy Ethereum since it's contingent on Ethereum doing well for your NFT to even be a thing that people would care about?
Yeah, I mean, I think you would buy NFTs because of the NFT bubble where the valuations just went absolutely crazy.
Right.
And so, it's like, in the long term, it is like a bet on Ethereum, but... For now, it's
I guess there's not really logic in buying NFTs for like trading. So maybe I shouldn't try to impose logical thinking on it.
Yeah,
but like to me, it just seems like, you know, NFTs aren't this like infinite thing where it's you mint an NFT in cyberspace.
Yeah,
and everyone
has to
respect that forever.
Yeah,
it's like, no, you minted it on a specific blockchain that if people don't give a shit about.
Yeah.
Then people won't give a shit about.
That's right. Yeah.
Good argument for Ordinals, I think.
Ordinals, which is my Bitcoin NFT project. Thank you. I was feeling nervous. I'm like, oh, I got to shill it, but you're shilling it for me.
Yeah.
That's why I'm trying to do NFTs on Bitcoin with no changes to Bitcoin and no other blockchain or whatever, just pure Bitcoin native NFTs. Because, we know that Bitcoin is going to be around forever. Like, I don't think it's really in doubt that Bitcoin or like, basically, Bitcoin is going to be around forever. So, with Bitcoin NFTs, you're not taking a bet on some other weird chain being around, having value, being functional.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Ordinals.com. There will only ever be... Yeah, each ordinal is a sat. It's just like sats. You can just attach NFTs to sats, and then you trade those sats around.
Yeah.
And then you can see who owns which sat. Very simple.
Yeah, that's cute.
Very
intuitive. It. Yeah.
The vibes are good?
The vibes are good.
Okay, yeah.
Even though the NFT vibes are bad overall.
Yeah, and the thing is that I would never make any sort of claim that this is going to be anything but like digital baubles. Like this is fun for Bitcoin collectors to like trade rare sats and then also to like decorate them with like NFTs and like have like cute weird digital art and like trade it on Bitcoin because that's fun. That's all it's ever going to be. And I'm going to be very happy if it's just that. It's not the future of art. It's not the future of anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, NFTs.
NFTs. Ordinals. Ordinals.com.
Ordinals.com. Yeah.
There we go.
I had to pay $2,000 for that.
Oh my God, Ordinals.com. Casey.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
All right. Cardano.
Cardano. Yeah. I mean, this is just, I had a plane ride with a really technical, really smart Cardano guy. And for the entire plane ride, I just grilled him about everything. Cardano is like another like chain. It's like trying to be an Ethereum competitor. Yeah. I just grilled him about everything in the Cardano ecosystem. And it's just like, it's so bad.
I mean, you met my friend who's also very smart Cardano guy.
Yeah.
But really nice.
He's smart. He's nice. No, this guy was like a high up, like very like major player.
The Cardano guy.
A major like Cardano guy. Very technical. And it was just like, he's just like following incentives. He's like, yeah, I can fund my company of like, you know, dozens of people just from like the fat floating in the Cardano ecosystem. Like, why wouldn't I, you know?
Yeah.
That's all I have to say about that.
That's kind of a grifter.
Yeah.
No offense.
Yeah. Kind of a grifter.
You know?
Yeah.
Buy Cardano.
Don't buy Cardano.
I'm saying buy Cardano.
Oh, buy Cardano. Yeah. Buy Cardano. Let's see. Proof of stake. We kind of talked about this. Stake ratchet. Strong centralization pressure. It merges miners and token holders. Bitcoin is this beautiful Mexican standoff where you have the developers, the exchanges, the miners, the users. Everybody sort of like has their own interests and is able to push for what they want and defend their interests.
It's like the checks and balances.
Checks and balances. Mm-hmm. If you take any two groups in Bitcoin, like let's say you took like exchanges and developers and merged them. And you're like, oh yeah, now all the developers work for exchanges or fully funded by exchanges, only do what exchanges want to do. That would be bad, right? That would be bad. Merging any group is bad. Because eventually you only have one group and that is like pretty...
The elites.
So the proof of stake, elitist, not for the plebs. Yeah. People asked me about Monero. I sort of posted on Twitter and I was like, hey, what do you want to hear about? So Monero kind of came from the early altcoin era, I would say. It's relatively non-awful. It had a fair launch, no pre-mine. It was community-driven. It does have some problems. So somebody asked me about Monero transaction size. Monero transactions are about 8 times larger than a Bitcoin transaction. So you can only have about 1/8 the amount of transactions per block.
Oof.
And kind of have like reasonable block size growth. I'm not sure about how expensive Ethereum transactions are to verify. It wouldn't surprise
Monero?
Me.
Monero?
Monero transactions. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if not only are they larger, but they're also more expensive. Other problems with Monero. Monero has a hard fork development philosophy where the developers get together, propose some changes, and then set a deadline for a hard fork of the network that implements those changes. And if you don't like those changes, you're just off the network. You're just done.
Ugh.
Yep.
I don't think the developers should have power.
No.
Just personally.
Nobody does.
I trust the miners only.
Oh, really? Okay. The miners. You weren't around for the block size wars. You can't trust anybody, basically.
Damn.
Yeah. But yeah, so this way of doing development means that the developers have a lot of power. They just make changes. They go down the pipe. And I don't think users can really resist developers in Monero.
Mm-hmm.
As far as privacy, though, privacy is good. Monero has okay privacy. When I go buy, when I go engage in free market activities on like dark net markets on the internet, buying, you know, goods, you know, I've had to use Monero in the past because some of these completely legitimate websites will only accept Monero, you know? Mm-hmm. But for privacy on Bitcoin, I would say Lightning is the way for sure. Mm-hmm. Lightning is, don't tell anybody, but the Lightning Network is just one giant mixnet that obscures all trace of like what happened and is pretty hard to surveil. So I think that actually we're going to develop a lot of sophisticated techniques for using Lightning in a very private way that will provide better privacy or equivalent privacy to Monero.
Nice.
Yep. Grin is kind of this next one is Grin.
I've like not even heard of Grin.
Yeah, I kind of mention it because it's an interesting an interesting sort of cautionary tale. Grin was a much hyped privacy coin that had very interesting privacy technology that was new and very novel. And it, I actually was very enthusiastic about Grin when it launched. I was like, oh, this is cool. It's a very cool privacy technology. It's very simple. I and some friends started this like kind of investment fund to let investors get exposure to Grin. That, you know, it went where it went. but basically Grin was absolutely dead in the water because there was no VC marketing budget. And like, it's like, it's a good coin. It has good technology, but went absolutely nowhere. And so that's sort of a lesson that like, yeah, all of these cryptos that are like popular, they're not succeeding because they have good tech. They're succeeding because of like the army of grifters, the army of moneyed grifters behind them who are like pushing them.
Totally.
Yeah. Zcash is another privacy coin like Monero. It's very centralized. Each block just rewards the core devs with a certain amount of money, the Zcash devs with money. So this means that you can't like fire the Zcash devs, right? Because they're hard coded into the protocol as receiving their like sinecure or whatever.
Talk about a nanny state.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. the other thing is that Zcash is wildly complicated. It uses like crazy zero knowledge crypto. I refer to this as moon math, sort of as a negative. And it's so complicated that there was a much publicized inflation bug that like somebody forgot to like they messed up a variable in a paper. And then downstream, the developers like implemented what was in the paper. And then months later, they discovered that actually anybody could use this to mint infinite amounts of Zcash. And they like quietly patched it up. And I think this kind of shows you that there's a real trade-off between Bitcoin with an auditable public supply and other coins where you're sort of, you're relying on more complicated, more technical moon mathy assurances that the supply is not being inflated. Like Bitcoin had an inflation bug. Somebody made a trivial problem, had a trivial bug in Bitcoin, led to some inflation. People noticed it immediately and like fixed it and reverted the chain to pre-inflation. That couldn't happen on Zcash. And in fact, this inflation bug, we believe that it was not exploited, but there's no way to know. There's no way to know that Zcash was not inflated and does not have a bunch of fake coins floating around. Somebody asked about Urbit. Urbit's kind of like, Urbit's interesting. Urbit's so like bizarre.
Urbit's not, there's no cryptocurrency for Urbit, right?
Well,
is there an Urbit coin?
Not really. So it's complicated. And Urbit's this network, this like peer-to-peer sort of like social network kind of thing that you can like run apps on and like other people can run apps. And it's very like Mountain Man, like cozy Mountain Man computer. Like imagine like you're like out and about in nature, you know, and then there's an avalanche and you like narrowly escape the avalanche with like some mountain man. Some mountain man finds you. He's like a cheerful like mountain man type, you know, and then your camp is fucked up. And so you go back to his like mountain man cabin. That
sounds like the intro to a porno.
No. Don't worry. This is not where that's going.
Imagine for a second.
No. I'm thinking like man. A Tom Bombadil kind of character. Not like a, you know, whatever. Virile lumberjack. So you go back to this mountain man's cabin and he has like a computer.
That's like, hey, babe, I'm running Urbit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's this very like cozy, like homesteading computer thing.
Yeah, I feel like I might be into it.
I think you'd kind of be into it. It does sort of have, it has something that has like a coin, like a token like aspect, which is the Urbit address space. So there's only enough, everyone on Urbit has a ship that's like your personal Urbit computer. And there's a limited number of like the good ships. The planets, as they're called. You need to own a planet.
Yeah.
Right. And unfortunately, the planets are on, they use Ethereum as the way to determine who owns them.
And GMI.
Yeah, I need to pitch them on ordinals.
Yeah, pitch them out. That could be a good thing for you. The Urbit guys are really loyal.
Yeah.
If you could get them using ordinals, you'd have that squad forever.
I honestly think ordinals solves all their problems. They could easily have every Urbit ship be an ordinal, and it would be way cheaper. They wouldn't have to do their weird, like, layer two bullshit.
Urbit guys.
Urbit guys. Yeah, call me. Call me. Call me.
We'll have our people contact your people.
Yeah. But Urbit is sort of a noble effort to decentralize, to sort of provide a future decentralized peer-to-peer internet computing kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's not a blockchain. It has this land, it has this Urbit address space, which is kind of like, you know, okay, yeah, that's kind of tokeny, but the core thing is not tokeny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then finally, like Web3, I don't even know what Web3 is. Web3 is just like, maybe we could use like, the best of Web3 is like, well, maybe we could use private keys to log into websites instead of passwords.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I like that.
I'm like into that.
Yeah. And also like,
but that's even from my non-technical perspective, that was the one thing that I identified from Web3 being like, that's cool.
Yeah, 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 yeah. but Web3 is always on Ethereum. I'm talking about Web5. Yeah, Web3 is like you're going to log into a website with a token. Web5 is like maybe we could just log into websites with private keys.
Yeah.
But that's also like Web1 kind of. Like there's the Web Authentication Protocol, which is a spec in development for enabling people to log into websites with private keys. So, yeah. And like a lot of people are just really confused about what Web3 can and can't do. And the answer is like not much.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just marketing.
Yeah.
I feel like if we could solve the bot problem through private keys, like if we could make it so that like you log into something, you have to like be a person.
Private keys don't solve that.
I don't even care about Web5.
No. The way that we solve that is Lightning. Your browser just has like a bag of sats. And like when you click things, it like pays sats as like a spam prevention measure. And these sats are so cheap that you never worry about, like, imagine Reddit where you had to pay like a fraction of a penny to like upvote something, you know?
I don't know about that. Maybe.
No. To the point where like you spent like 50 cents a month on like Reddit upvotes as like a user, essentially.
That would crash the entire Reddit upvote economy, Casey.
It would crash the spam economy. I mean, it would.
It would. I mean, mostly I say this like, I'm just really curious to see what a lot of websites would look like without bots. Mm. Like, I kind of subscribe to the conspiracy theory that the internet's dead.
Yeah, the internet's like, dead. Nobody can tell.
Yeah. Like, Twitter feels dead.
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah.
There's certain websites where I'm like, what if we just make it so there's actually only human beings here? Like, might change fucking everything.
I mean, and like, the way to do that is make people pay for things. Like, you have to introduce a cost. But the thing is that if the cost is so low, you don't care. Like, let's say in this future I'm talking about, every month you load your browser up with $10. And this sort of pays for all the, like, clicks and interactions that you want to do over the next month because each one is so cheap. And there's no CAPTCHAs. There's no spam. You log in with your private keys. The content is way better. Everything just kind of works better. And it costs $10 a month.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you, like, market it as, like, an internet bill, then of course.
What do you mean an internet bill?
Like, you already pay money to get the internet, you know?
Right.
So if you're like, oh, this $10 a month is, like, your internet usage, like, to keep the internet, like,
well,
fun and great.
But simultaneously, know? Like, it just makes it, it's not just keep the internet what it is. It's like, yeah, make it way better, right?
That's what I mean. Like, if you can market it as just, like, this is just part of your internet bill.
Yeah.
Like, and it's what keeps the internet great.
Yeah.
Then, like, sure.
Yeah.
You know, I'd pay that.
Okay.
Whatever.
Yeah. That's where we're going. It's going to be good. Yeah.
The best. But I want to pay it in Dogecoin.
Best example of that is no. Because Dogecoin, I don't know if Dogecoin is the Lightning Network. Who fucking knows? But the best example of that is Stacker News, which is like a Reddit-like, Hacker News Reddit-like site where you pay sats for each upvote.
Hmm.
Yeah.
But you have to learn Hacker News?
No, it's just like Reddit. You just click buttons. Like,
oh, yeah. But this is called Hacker News.
It's called Stacker News.
Oh, Stacker News.
Yeah, on a play like StatSacker.
Yeah, so it's just Bitcoin news?
Yeah, pretty much now. But they're going to branch off. The early community is like hardcore Bitcoin people. Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's what they all say.
Yeah.
Okay, should we wrap it up? I mean, we've You went off.
Oh, yeah. We need to wrap it up.
Yeah.
But yeah, we got it.
We got through it all.
Yep.
Great. Thanks for your questions, everyone.
Absolutely.
We appreciate them.
Oh, yeah. Somebody asked me about charity and like social giving.
Mm-hmm.
Bitcoin's great for that. Just give people money. It's the best money.
Easy answer.
Yeah.
Great. Just shilling our bags over here.
Yeah.
Ordinals.com.
Yeah.
Thanks for watching, listening.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'll catch you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.